Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation. It is Monday, June 10th. The Falls of Clyde is a step closer to being removed from Honolulu Harbor. The final environmental assessment is out. Why the Friends of Falls of Clyde group isn't happy. Disaster preparedness, are we ready, even after what we saw in Lahaina? A recently published study shares some startling results. We'll hear from the lead researcher. FESPAC 2024 is in full swing after thousands gathered to witness the historic opening ceremonies last Friday. Today we hear from participants after the first weekend. And local musician Irie Love is set to release her newest single this week, the first in a series of big projects lined up for the near future. She shares how her life and her music have evolved in recent years. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The options for the historic ship Falls of Clyde are laid out on the table, and its future isn't looking very bright. The Federal Register published the environmental assessment, the final EA, for the iron vessel on Saturday. This morning we hear from the State Harbors Division and the Friends of the Falls of Clyde, which owns the ship. It took possession after Bishop Museum abandoned ownership and closed the Maritime Museum there at the docks. The options include cutting up the vessel, sinking it for use as an artificial reef, or hauling it out for a possible return to Glasgow, Scotland. The ship has already been removed from the state and federal register, and what remains is a signature from the head of the U.S. Interior Secretary for final removal from Pier 7. But Deputy Harbors Director Dre Khalili says going out to bid on the final removal doesn't need to wait on that. She outlines the options and hopes to go out to bid for the project by the end of the summer.
We could award the contract to someone who proposes to return it to Scotland or return it to some port outside of Hawaii, and that's definitely an option. Scuttling at sea is also an option. In the past, previous owners of the vessel contemplated towing the vessel out to the EPA ocean disposal site, which is about 13 miles offshore from Honolulu Harbor. Also an option here, although additional approvals would be required to do that. Breaking it and dismantling in its place and then disposing of the parts is also another option. The option that you mentioned that is probably less likely is going to be for a dive site. A lot of the dive sites that exist around our shores are quite shallow, and so given the size of the vessel, we may not have a, let's say, successful sinking. It's got to fall in a very specific location and very specific angle, and then we've got to make sure there's enough clearance between the highest point of the vessel once it's settled and the surface. So I think that's less likely of an option, and there are additional approvals that need to be granted in order for that to happen. But I think the other options of the dismantling in place, return to Scotland or return to another port, just removal out of Hawaii's waters or ocean disposal. Those are likely the pathways forward that will come out of the request for proposal.
Talk about the structural stability of the pier. How would that work when you cut the ship up?
That's a great question. So the pier where the vessel is berthed, it's condemned. So the planks that form the pier, you know, they're sagging. It's unsafe. I think even unsafe for folks to walk on at this point. So when we dismantle it, we would probably need to use a portion of the pier that isn't Pier 7, like where it's burst now, but maybe along the roadway at Alohatar Drive that runs in front of Alohatar Marketplace in Pier 7. You know, that's fast land. That's where the road is. So we may have to use a portion of the road in the dismantling process. We also expect that if someone proposes this method of disposal, they would use a crane barge that would pull alongside the vessel and do the dismantling, you know, from the water side.
Okay, and then there's also the potential impact to Hawaii Pacific University, which has moved into the Alohatau Marketplace.
Yes, so what we expect, and we noted this in the environmental assessment and also collected comments through the comment period about considerations that we should think through if this is the method of disposal. So we may need to take the sidewalk and maybe part of the lane of travel on Aloha Tower Drive. But once we have the proposals in hand and understand what the work plan is, then we can speak more specifically about what the impact to that area might be and for how long.
And the EA, you know, raised the issues of dust, noise, that kind of thing. And then do we have any handle on how long that dismantling might take?
Some firms who perform this type of work, we've had preliminary discussions just for planning purposes, just so we can have in mind exactly the questions that you just asked. So some have said that they might be able to do a dismantling in 2 to 3 weeks. But I don't want to just focus on dismantling. If the removal of the vessel, just by towing it out or having a heavy lift ship come in, which has been an option proposed by those interested in restoring this vessel and repatriating it back to Scotland, I mean, that could happen as soon as a vessel is available to come to Honolulu Harbor to retrieve the Falls of Clyde. And, you know, that could be very quick. And that may not have the impact that you had described about dust and noise and everything associated with dismantling by breaking the ship at the pier.
Okay. In the past, though, DOT has raised the concern about hurricane season. And while, you know, we are forecast for a pretty mild one, that is still a concern, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, we are interested in taking this action as quickly as possible. It took us a little longer, I think, than we expected to finalize the environmental assessment. There are some other issues that we are working through, including, you know, there being some artifacts that remain on board. And should the request for proposals yield a contract to someone who's going to dismantle it, we want to make sure that the artifacts are cared for and removed properly. However, if the outcome of the contracting process is the vessel is repatriated to Scotland or just taken to another port somewhere, you know, those artifacts very well could remain on board because the provenance and everything, you know, those artifacts should just stay with the vessel.
Okay, so you could maybe work out some kind of memorandum of understanding?
Yeah. I mean, we just want to make sure that whatever the outcome of the contracting award and the RFP process is, that, you know, those artifacts are maintained well. And so when you ask about hurricane season, I think we're just looking for the quickest way for us to, let's say, quote, remove the vessel. And, you know, hopefully that can be done in a very safe manner and maybe before the end of this current hurricane season.
The boat that operates here, the cruise?
The Star of Honolulu.
Star of Honolulu, yeah. Is there no other pier that they can operate out of?
So the arrangements that we have with that vessel, you know, where they are now at Pier 8, that's their, let's call it, home base. But in the past, we have relocated them. Like when we have to do substructure repairs at that pier, we'll relocate them to a nearby pier. So it's usually, you know, Pier 9 right around the corner from where they currently are. And so depending, again, on what proposal we select
right.
for the removal of the vessel, we may also need to relocate some of our maritime operations.
That was State Harbors Division Deputy Director Dre Khalili talking to us this morning about the fate of the historic vessel, the Falls of Clyde. It is the last of the Iron Hold four-masted ships. And for the last decade and a half, the nonprofit group Friends of the Falls of Clyde worked to restore it. And it had hoped to transfer ownership to another organization from Scotland in order to get the ship returned back home. Those plans have been in limbo. We talked to Bruce McEwen about the group's concerns with the final environmental assessment. He spoke to us this morning to try and set the record straight and to get the state to acknowledge its inaction contributed to the current situation.
My biggest problem with the way that the EA is written is the fact that it makes some, in my biased opinion, some unfounded comments about the failure of the ship to be maintained over the years without mentioning anywhere in the EA the role that the Harbors Division played in undercutting the plans of the Friends of Falls of Clyde. In 2014, we were prepared to start a process to put the ship into dry dock and then begin a phased restoration. And that is when the Harbors Division all of a sudden started talking publicly about the ship being a hazard in the harbor to the maritime operations. That was 10 years ago. And, you know, we were just unable to gather any financial support after we knew the Harbors Division was against us. And after the impoundment in 2016, it was virtually impossible to move forward. even though that wasn't the purpose, necessarily the history that went into the environmental assessment, they could have put in something about the fact that the Harbors Division was not supportive of Friends of Falls of Clyde from 2014, you know, coming forward. Had they supported us and allowed us without making any negative comments, and even the initial step of responding when we provided them with, in 2014, with a dry dock plan and a business plan, both of those were totally ignored. They didn't come back and ask any questions. They didn't come back and say, oh, this looks like a plan. You know, what are the details? Nothing. They just remained silent and moved forward with starting to make the negative comments about the ship. Had they been supportive of us like they were back in 2008 when we took possession of the ship, none of this would have happened.
This EA points out that the option of cutting up the ship there at the docks, that the piers there are not in good shape and they can't handle the weight of that ship.
Yeah, I mean, we worked on that pier from 2008 to 2019, and we were very, you know, very much aware of the lack of strength of the pier. There's a very small concrete pad. Most of it in the area of that pier is wood. So the other option they had about taking it off-site, that would help with the idea that Pier 7 isn't the place to do it, but then the transport issue, they also say is a big risk.
The state did try to push this, and they were hoping to, you know, go out for a bit, I think the first quarter of this year, but we're already in hurricane season, and so, yeah, those options then get a little bit more tricky.
Yeah, the only thing is, I think that the weather folks are indicating that we probably aren't going to have bad hurricane season. And the reality is, again, over the last 16 years during our period of ownership, there's never been a serious weather problem that had any impact on the ship or its alleged hazard to the harbor. There's always that, you know, what if this happens? But the fact is that it hasn't happened in many, many years.
The state is allowing you to go on the ship and possibly take anything of historic value.
Well, they sent us a letter in May giving us until June the 19th to come aboard and remove any artifacts that we wanted to maintain in our possession. And that takes a lot of logistic decision making. But what really raised our hackles was that they said if we didn't do it by June 19th, that anything we didn't take off would become the property of the state. And they cited a Hawaii revised statute, which we checked, and that particular statute refers to a historic document. It says nothing at all about physical property or historic artifacts. So, you know, we've seen this before, that they meaning, unfortunately, both the DOT, Attorney General's Office, and that, have used Hawaii revised statutes in a way that we think is misinterpreted just to make it sound like they know what they're doing.
So is it your feeling that you would take some items off there?
The short answer is yes, but as I've already written to the Deputy Director of Harbors and said, hey, we're not going to remove anything by June 19th, and you know, B, we have some legal issues that we're going to be researching. But the fact is that until we know exactly what's going to happen to the ship, it would be premature to take off anything. The second part of that is in the EA, there's a identified areas of historic artifacts that are actually bolted to the deck of the ship. And so in the EA, whoever the contractor is going to be would have to be sure that they preserve those artifacts because they do have maritime importance that a maritime museum on the mainland or anywhere else might want to preserve those for their own exhibit. So the idea of removing artifacts is at this point premature and ultimately is going to be sort of a sensitive issue on how that can be done in keeping the artifacts intact.
That was Bruce McEwen with the Friends of the Falls of Clyde. McEwen says if the ship is removed, it is his hope that the historic artifacts could find a home in a museum or that some area can be dedicated at Honolulu Harbor to commemorate the ship's history. The state is negotiating a long-term lease for the old Maritime Museum property with a Seattle company. Details about that project and cost analysis of the substructure are expected to be made public soon. Kalili says our harbors statewide are in need of upgrading. To give you some context, the Aloha Tower Marketplace is to celebrate its centennial in 2026.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Alanis Morissette. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about various versions of service in the world and how we can show up as our truest selves to serve.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Keith and Polly Steiner Family Foundation, in memory of Keith and Polly Steiner and their support of charitable organizations that seek to improve and uplift the human condition in Hawaii and throughout the world.
As we head into hurricane and wildfire season, a recent study among Hawaii families found that we are nowhere near as prepared for disasters as we should be. More than 250 Oahu parents of young children were surveyed about their emergency readiness, and less than a third had an emergency plan and a preparedness kit, while more than a third were fully unprepared. That study was led by Gary Globerman, an assistant professor at the University of Hawaii Nursing School. He spoke to The Conversation's Maddie Bender about the results of his recent study and what families should do in the absence of official guidelines and policies on emergency preparedness.
As a nurse, I was a Red Cross disaster nurse volunteer. I started off locally responding to house fires and assisting with retrieving supplies or medications that had been lost in the fire and helping families navigate the really complex situations that happen after disaster. And after I got some experience here locally, I was sent nationally to some tornadoes in the southern area of our country, as well as a large hurricane, Hurricane Sandy. And from there, really helped a lot of people, but at the same time, noticed that some people are hit harder than others, and some people have a much harder time recovering from others. And so that really got me interested in learning about different ways that people prepare for emergencies and the different support systems that are in place within communities to help people after disasters. And coming into my role as a nurse educator and nurse scientist, I'm now interested in leading research that works towards informing programs and policies that promote health and wellness, and specifically in the area of emergency preparedness for disasters in our state.
So what are the key factors and variables involved predicting someone's response to an emergency or predicting someone's level of preparedness?
It's really important. Our research aimed to find out what families in Hawaii are doing to prepare for emergencies like natural disasters. To step back, some of the most basic recommendations for preparing families for emergencies, these will include building an emergency preparedness kit, and this is a collection of supplies that families need to sustain themselves after disasters like food, water, and medicines. And another recommendation is to make a family emergency plan, and that's a plan that lays out what families will do during emergencies, like where to evacuate to and how to reunite with family members if you're separated. And so in one of our studies, we conducted an online survey that included nearly 300 Oahu parents of young children. And we asked them about these specific emergency preparedness behaviors. And we found that among this group, less than one third of the participants had both an emergency preparedness kit and a family emergency plan.
Wow.
And there were more than one third who did not have either of those. So in this study, the persons who were considered prepared were outnumbered by those who were not at all prepared for emergencies. it does show that there's a lot of work to be done. And we also found in this study some factors that might kind of help us understand why that is. We did see that persons who believe that emergency preparedness is important or those who felt they're at risk for disasters were more likely to be prepared. And then on the flip side, persons who felt they did not have enough time or they didn't have enough knowledge to prepare their families for emergencies, those persons were less likely to have an emergency preparedness kit or a plan. We also conducted interviews with other families, and we found there are other barriers involved as well for preparing for emergencies. These included not having enough resources to maintain preparedness kits, or not having enough transportation to evacuate, or not understanding emergency preparedness information due to language barriers. And so there are a lot of ways that we can adjust what we're doing to meet the needs that people have and help them overcome some of these barriers that they may face.
Are there recommendations based on some of these factors that have led to actual improvements in the way that we talk about and engage in emergency preparedness in the state?
One of the elements of our study did ask the participants to provide us with some suggestions on how to help them better prepare for their pre-emergencies and overcome some of the barriers. And so some of these are definitely worth investigating or looking into. So, for example, one of the suggestions was to involve healthcare providers in emergency preparedness planning. Parents described they'd be willing to receive emergency preparedness guidance during their regular child health checkups or even at key times, such as when school is starting up or during hurricane season. And another example that they provided a suggestion was to develop technology-based tools such as apps or websites that would help customize emergency preparedness guidance to the specific needs of the family. Right now, we'll tell families to go to the Department of Health website or the CDC, and a lot of the information there is extremely general, and some of the families felt that it really didn't apply to them. Something really unique that is well known in Hawaii and something that I experienced as a responder with the American Red Cross and helping other persons in disasters is that we have really large households in Hawaii. So that's a very cultural thing, you know. Tutu lives with the keiki and everybody in between. And so when we're thinking about emergency preparedness here in Hawaii, we're thinking about a really broad range of ages. And with that comes a broad range of health needs. You know, kupuna have different needs from working age persons and little keiki have different health needs as well. And something that families probably don't do that often, but we could do more often, is to sit down with each other and think about developing an emergency preparedness plan that includes all the anticipated needs of each of the family members. You know, what types of medications would we need just in case we run out of electricity? What types of specific foods are needed by little children in the family? So those are some things that could be done at the household level to help each other prepare for emergencies. Of course, we're promoting that each individual household should be prepared for the emergency and looking at the family unit. But there's things that we could do outside of the family and outside the household that could improve overall community preparedness for emergencies. So talking about preparedness with your neighbor and describing things that you're worried about in terms of disasters that will affect the neighborhood. Even small conversations like that will bring awareness to people around you. Or maybe you're a family member who has a small child at the elementary school and asking the school, what's the school's emergency plan in case there's a disaster where I'm unable to come to school? What's going to happen? Where are the children going to be? How will I reunite with them? Those are some things that we could do concretely without having to wait for any major policies to happen. We can start this with our own neighborhood.
I wanted to bring up also another study gauging emergency preparedness in the aftermath of the false missile alert and thinking about whether it's at all possible to extrapolate some of those results to what might have happened for people after the Maui fires.
Yeah, I recall that study. And one of the things we learned about that study is that people did actually change their emergency preparedness behaviors based off of that experience. It was a very scary experience for many persons to have been informed that there's an incoming missile to Hawaii. And we did ask, hey, based on this experience of having received this text message, what changes did you make to your preparedness for your family? And we did actually find significant differences. People really did change their behaviors. And so one of the things that's relevant from that study, the current situation, is that when disasters are at the forefront of a person's mind, that is the best time to engage with people regarding emergency preparedness, because people are extremely focused. It's a very salient issue. It's front of mind. And so that's an excellent time for healthcare providers, community workers to really bring up the topic of emergency preparedness.
Let me turn the question to you. So how are you prepared for emergencies?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's interesting. One thing that I like to do is keep supplies for myself in my car, because you never know when you're stuck in traffic or you're not able to get home. So that's one thing. And, you know, another thing that I've done since looking at the Maui fires is reviewing my insurance policies and making sure that I have enough coverage. So that's another thing that I've learned having watched some of these situations.
That was Gary Lauberman of the UH School of Nursing talking to HBR's Maddie Bender. His recent study was published in the journal Disaster Medicine and Public Health Preparedness. He recommends that listeners check out the Department of Health's website, preparenowhawaii.org, to learn more about what they can do to be ready for disasters. We'll have a link to both on the conversation page of our website after the show.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Mobi, a Hawaii wireless company since 2005, featuring a locally based customer care team committed to problem solving and personal service for each client. Learn more at Mobi.com.
Aloha, I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak, host of The Body Show. Each week we do our best to provide you with up-to-date medical information from our local experts that might help you or someone you love know more about the world of medicine. Join us today for our latest episode at 6:30 right here on The Body Show.
Support for HPR comes from the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, committed to supporting Native Hawaiian homeowners and renters impacted by the Maui wildfires. More about its Kanaho grant at oha.org/kanaho grant.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Slather on the sunscreen and put on your hiking boots for today's backyard quiz. We are peering through our binoculars in search of a unique plant that has turned the tables on insects and eats them. You may know of the Venus flytraps of North Carolina or the tropical pitcher plants of Malaysia, but did you know that Hawaii has a native carnivorous plant? It's a species of sundew, and though the name sounds charming, it actually sounds the death knell for small insects. The plant's alluring and sparkly tentacles are gluey death traps. Hawaiians call it mikinalo, or fly sucker, and only live insects will do, so no raw meat. And they get all their nutrients from their prey. No fertilizer is necessary to encourage it to flower. If you want to find a mikinalo in the wild, there is only one island where it can be found. Our backyard quiz question for you today: on what island is the mikinalo found? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, supporting nonprofits such as the Molokai Affordable Housing Alliance, providing kupuna with resources for building affordable homes on Molokai. NareitHawaii.com.
Can you believe we are halfway through FestBack 2024? It is day five of the 10-day Culture and Arts Festival. HBR reporter Cassie Ordonio joins us. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Oh, my gosh. So watching the opening ceremonies, I attended some events this weekend. Boy, what a feast for the senses.
And this is the first time that we are having FestBack in 8 years after the COVID-19 pandemic. And it's not every day that we get to see Pacific Islanders all in one space.
You've been attending these events all weekend.
I haven't slept. I'm just kidding. But that was, those were cultural dancers from Papua New Guinea, one of the most diverse islands in the Pacific Islands, specifically in Melanesia. And that was a clip from the opening ceremony on Thursday, which was 8 hours long. So when they say 4 to 9, well, we were running on Pacific Island time for sure.
Yes, I know. We got done like after 10:30.
I think it was 12:15. I stayed the whole entire time. But it was very beautiful. We're definitely not on Western time. But, when FestBack was created in 1972, this was after these elders of the Pacific, mostly in Melanesia, raising concerns over the erosion of culture and the arts and trying to preserve that. And at the time, it was called the Festival of Arts, I believe. And then later on, it became FestPack because it became more inclusive of Polynesia and Micronesia. And it's kind of just been rotating around the Pacific every 4 years, other than the COVID-19 pandemic, of course. But it was really interesting. I got to talk to some delegates last week. So I spoke to two artists from Papua New Guinea in the Melanesia region, and I spoke with a Chamorro carver who's originally, he has roots mostly from Guam and Saipan. But Gisela Bruder, she's the Papua New Guinea artist, and she says there's an importance of FestPack to highlight the balance of preserving traditional art and mixing it with contemporary art.
If we don't have some kind of boundary, we will just get all lost in the masses, just go with the tide. And I think that's where, I think for us as indigenous, as natives of our land, everything is attached to the land that we originate from, and what better way to express it than through the art forms that we have, and we have an opportunity to continue to exist.
Yeah, it's just been so wonderful to see the different versions of, headdresses and, the different weaving and feathers and shells. It's amazing.
And even seeing the delegates interact with each other. Like, for example, folks from Papua New Guinea, they'll see, folks from Samoa, and they'll be asking, oh, where are you from? Oh, I'm from Samoa. And the Samoans will be like, oh, where are you from? And they get really excited just, seeing where they're from and having these conversations. For example, Gisela was telling me that even though she was more into painting and printmaking, she always wanted to be a sculptor. But when just last week, she met with a group of Chamorro carvers who were women, and she saw how they were making spondylus and sinahi, those necklaces that adorn their necks that are made out of shells. But when she saw that, that actually inspired her to get into sculpting. And now she wants to sculpt with metal and wood materials using these tools that the Chamorro carvers are using. But she's been in conversation with them, trying to kind of use their craft, but then embed it into her own work to where she can reflect her culture. But speaking of carvers, I also spoke with Mario Borja. He's a carver with roots from Guam and Saipan, and he created that canoe named Tsetlu from the Va'a ceremony.
Everyone in this country, in our whole of Oceania, Melanesia, Polynesia, and Micronesia, they all have their wisdom, how they succeed, how they can promote their culture. Culture and language are embedded. I believe that if you enhance your culture, your language would follow. But at the same, if you ignore your culture, your language would also suffer the same. So the collection of cultures, collection of languages, all seem to have some kind of commonality. You know, drumming, fishing, canoeing, seafaring, chanting, all these things are interwoven with one huge oceanic fabric. One oceanic fabric that we are all part of.
Yeah, you know, I remember watching the opening ceremony, and there was a line that one of the leaders said, and he says, we're not just people from tiny islands. We are the caretakers of the world's largest ocean. And I was just, wow.
That's Vice Speaker Miguel. That was my favorite speaker,
yes.
Too. I actually told him
Powerful.
You were his favorite.
Powerful.
He was blushing.
Yeah.
And also, I've also been hearing from some of the delegates that, you know, there are some, like, logistics and whatnot. So some of the delegates, they were still trying to get their SIM cards. And for me as a reporter, trying to get a hold of them, sometimes we have to use WhatsApp, or I just meet them wherever they are.
Yeah, yeah. And I know for people who are wanting to, you know, go to the convention center, there's some, you know, issues about parking. And that's not a very large parking lot in the convention center. So people need to go to, I believe it's Alamoana Shopping Center by Bloomingdale's, I think is where they set aside. But things like that, because you want as many people as possible to see this incredible event.
Yeah. Yeah, and like what Aaron Salas said, I know this festival won't be perfect, but it's a work in progress.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Cassie.
Thank you.
We've been talking with HBR's Cassie Ordonio. We'll have links to the festival schedule on our website as organizers are constantly updating information.
Hey there, it's Michael Barbaro, host of The Daily. Join us for an in-depth look into the world's biggest stories. Catch The Daily Monday through Thursday at 1:30 here on HPR One.
It's no secret buying a house is tough right now, so would-be buyers are taking the help where they can get it.
First-time buyers are needing help from their parents to actually co-sign those mortgages because, you know, they maybe don't even have the incomes to qualify in the first place.
I'm Kai Rizdal, parental, paying for a house. Next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6.
Now it's time to feed you the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about a type of sundew or carnivorous plant that makes its home on one of the major Hawaiian islands. Its Hawaiian name is Mikanalo, and when viewed in full sun, the plant is lovely to look at, with sparkling beads glinting on its surface. But don't let the pretty picture fool you. These drudops are death traps for tiny insects. Its sticky grasp holds the critters until they give up their struggle and become lunch. And that's the only lunch it can have. Do not try to feed a Mikanalo any raw meat or even fertilizer. You'll probably kill it. To see a Mikanalo in the wild, you may have to island hop unless you happen to be on the garden aisle, which is the answer to today's backyard quiz. And you may need to do some hiking. This member of the sundew family, which is usually found in the bogs of the Alaka'i wilderness, can be sighted high atop the misty central plateau of Kauai. Thanks to the Nature Conservancy of Hawaii for this quiz. And congrats to our winner, David Delaney on Oahu. You got it right. If you have an idea for a quiz, send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Local music artist Irie Love is releasing her new single, To Be Free this Friday with the video to follow later this month. It's the first of several new projects from the celebrated reggae artist this year. Her first full-length album comes out later this year, which she recorded in Paris, and she hopes to publish a book next year. She also made her network TV debut recently when she appeared on the NCIS Hawaii season finale. All this comes after she returned to making music 2 years ago following a 5-year break. The conversation's Russell Subiano sat down with Love in our studio to talk about how she's grown and evolved.
I was made for you. You were made for me. I feel like I had met you in another life.
Since you've returned to music, what have you learned about yourself? How have you changed or evolved?
I mean, there's so many layers to that answer. I actually just recently lost my father November 30th to cancer. And so in the process of actually making the new album, he was in his final days. And I made the album in Paris, so I was very far away from where he was. He actually moved to Texas about 4 or 5 years ago when he retired from HPD. And so I think most recently that has affected me deeply because it was dealing with losing my father and at the same time finally coming back to something that I really truly love and feel like I'm purposed to do in this life. And of course, the whole time I'm FaceTiming him through the process and he was encouraging me to, you know, not leave early, don't leave without finishing the album, because it had been such a big step for me to stop completely and decide to come back. And he knew what that took emotionally and spiritually for me. So it was a beautiful dance of gratitude and grief is how I've been describing it. And so that definitely has opened me up on a totally new level in most recent. I mean, that was only a few months ago. When I took the break, the process of healing, it's interesting how people will always use healing is like, oh, I'm on my healing journey, as if we like heal in one period of our lives and then we're all healed, you know? But I feel like healing is just an aspect of being alive, right? We ebb and flow through different contrast and pain and things that will just catch us out of nowhere, like people passing away or, you know, different things that come up in life, and we have to heal and process from that. And so the beautiful thing with music is that it is a modality that can help me heal, and then I share it and it helps others heal, and then we all heal together. So I definitely feel like I'm stepping into this era for myself of really becoming who I really came to be and understanding, or innerstanding, I like to say, my true kuleana in this life. So it's been an interesting journey these last few years.
You've been performing for nearly a quarter century. I don't want
to. No, let's say it. I love to say that I started in the late 1900s.
Right. And so when you're an artist up on the stage in front of an audience, when you're someone who has a following and a fan base like you do, I feel like you also have this opportunity to impact people in a unique way. Do you look at performing and making music today differently than you did when you first started singing, like, you know, way back in like Brown Bags days?
Yeah, absolutely. Not only do I feel that I've been maybe like 3 or 5 versions of myself, but when I first started, I had an inner resistance to singing. I wanted to be an athlete, and I thought that that was my purpose. So yeah, definitely when I started, it was just like everyone around me was encouraging me to do it. And I felt like I must be good enough because of the response of others. But it was such an external validation at that point that I really was doing it for other people. And I just only recently discovered that what that did was it put me in a position where I was creating music for other people. And I didn't really focus a lot on what I saw other artists doing, which was making music that I love and then inviting people to share that love with me. So now that's what I do, but I think for the majority of my career, especially being in reggae, and so there was a lot of times where it was just like, this is the music, this is the key that it's in, make something up fast, right? And so doing that wasn't really my ideal situation as far as really falling in love with what I was creating. It didn't feel as organic as what I'm doing now. When I went to Paris, we literally created things from scratch. I had ideas that I had written when I was living in Seattle teaching spin and yoga that I brought to Paris, and we made them into songs. So it definitely has been a much more organic experience where I love this album. And so if nobody else loves it, at least I love it. I'm going to rock it all the time, you know? Yeah. And so to be in that angle or that perspective in my art is kind of making it for me feel brand new.
Let's talk about your single.
So Sugar's already out.
Sugar's already out.
Yeah, okay. Sugar came out in January. Okay. I released it on the weekend of my sister's birthday. That's how I remember it, because she's actually the one that wrote the song for me.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so my younger sister and I were able to come together and create a song. I finished it in Paris, but she wrote it for me, and it was kind of like, you know, one of the greatest wishes of my father is for his daughters to make music together. And so it was really beautiful to be able to do that. So I had to make that the first single. But the next single is a song called To Be Free. And we created a beautiful music video for that as well. And we shot four different scenes, which I've never done before, at the Sandbar, at this beautiful property in Kaneohe, my friend Danny Kassler's property, at the beach in Waimanalo, where I grew up and I still go to today, and then at Makapu with a fire dancer and that whole element. So I wanted to just really showcase all the different stages of life that I've been through thus far the music video.
One of the underlying themes of Sugar is resilience and hope. In your lyrics, you say, after the sun sets every night, it rise again, shine again. Same can be true with relationships. Sometimes you give more than you get, but hold on for that sweet, sweet loving.
After the sun sets every night, it rise again, shine again. Same can be true with relationships. Sometimes you get more than you get, but hold on, hold on for that sweet, sweet love.
Where does your resilience and your hope come from?
The song is about self-love and how I learned to love myself so that I didn't need that external validation anymore, right? So for me, the way that I really feel confident and just really was able to get to this place where I no longer need that external validation is through discipline. So discipline for me is an example that I've seen in just a few of my family members, but a lot of times we see it in athletes. And, you know, being an athlete for most of my life, I understand the embodiment of what that is. And so for me today, discipline with what I eat, discipline consumption in general, so consuming with my eyes, consuming with my ears, consuming with my mouth, and even just like the company that I keep, the energy that I allow to be in my space or that I am willing to be a part of is something that I've become extremely disciplined about. And so the energy that we have around us or put into our bodies in any way, it affects who we are. And so to have discipline in that way, I stopped drinking alcohol on my 40th birthday, which was, I'm going to be 42 this year. So when was that? 21?
Yeah.
July 2021.
Yeah.
So July 2021, I stopped drinking alcohol. And, you know, I drank all the time socially for most of my adult life. And that was just a decision that was actually really easy for me. I just got to a place where I feel like my body is a temple and I don't need to, you know, have alcohol to have a good time. I never really did. That was never really an aspect for me. It was just kind of like, we're all at the beach with the barbecue and you're having the Heinekens, you like one drink, you know, it's just like that. Yeah, exactly. Or having wine night with the girls or so it was very casual, but at the same time, it was consistently poisoning myself. And I had to really come to that realization. And also just like I'm a vegetarian now. I grew up, you know, eating teriyaki steak and Kualoa pig and all the kind of things. But I just feel like for me, and this doesn't mean that this is the only way for other folks to be disciplined, but just as an example of what my personal choices have been that have really made me feel empowered.
I did want to ask you about your album that's coming out later this year. From what I've read, it's your first actual album that you are putting together. It seems like a lot of your music has been released in singles. What led you to want to do an album this time around?
Yeah, so I had some streaming success with a song that I created with this particular producer who made the entire album now. A few years ago, In Another Life was a single that we created and released, and it went to like over a million streams in a few months or something. And then it was mostly in Europe, and then it's like over 3 million now. And so basically my manager and I were trying to figure out the formula because I was trying to create with many different people in Seattle and California, and then of course virtually, and just nothing was really clicking. And so he was like, okay, chemistry. You already have chemistry with this French producer. I had never met him before in person. And he's like, what if I just sent you to Paris and you made an album with him? And I'm like, I'm not going to turn down a trip to Paris.
Right.
Even though I don't speak French, I do love croissants and I know how to say merci beaucoup. So I was able to get by. But yeah, long story short, I went there for like a little over a month and it was kind of like a regular job. I went in the morning and I went home in the evening and clock in and clock out at the studio. And we were just able to create this magical album together that was just like, it was so easy. It just flowed for both of us. And he was able to read my ideas and bring them to fruition. He plays almost every instrument. So I could just like hum a bass line and he would find it. And then we'd figure out what was the most comfortable key for my voice. So yeah, I've never done any of that before. Shout out to my first mentor, Fiji. I remember so many times in the studio, he's like, this is the music. Like, you have to sing in this key. And it wasn't necessarily a comfortable key for my voice. And so now I'm learning, like, actually, you can transpose things to be comfortable. And right. Then finding different aspects of my voice, too. Like, this album, I've expressed different parts of my voice that I've never used before. So it's really interesting to see how the voice as an instrument is so expansive. And when you can really sit and organically create something piece by piece, what can come to life is just, it's been really magical.
Irie, those are all the questions that I had. Thank you so much for coming in. It's so cool to catch up with you. It's so great to see you doing so well.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you always.
And I know I was made for you. You were made for me. I feel like I had met you in another life. In this time and space.
That was music artist Irie Love talking with HBR's Russell Subiono. Love's new single, To Be Free, will be released this Friday on all major streaming platforms. Her yet-to-be-titled album is set for release in August. That does it for us today. Tomorrow, we take a break for the Kamehameha Day holiday, but we will be back on Wednesday. Do you have an idea to share with us? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. You can also find the conversation available as a podcast on our website or on Spotify, Apple, or Google. I'm Catherine Cruz. We will be back again on Wednesday with more of the conversation.